with variable high cloudiness and gusty winds. Gusty winds at times around the corner of Sunset and Alvarado. Yeah, I know, things are tough all over. When the thunderstorms start increasing over the southeast and south central portions of my apartment, I get upset. And a line of thunderstorms was developing in the early morning hours ahead of a slow-moving cold front. Cold-blooded. With tornado watches issued shortly before noon Sunday for the areas including the western region of my mental health and the northern portion of my ability to deal rationally with my disconcerted, precarious emotional situation. Cold out there. Colder than a ticket taker's smile at the Ivor Theater on Saturday night. Flash flood watches cover the southern portion of my disposition. Yeah. There was no severe weather well into the afternoon, except for kind of a low and gust wind in the bedroom.
And ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Wednesday edition. It is a wonderful day to have you all with me, 25th of January. I am thewitness.com is my website, and I am thewitness@hotmail.com is my email. And it is great to be here today to do the show. I got a hot cup of tea set in front of me by my wife, which is nice. And it's freezing cold out here in France. It's 10 o'clock at night, 10:06. And it's, again, we're getting down into the low 20s, high teens tonight. So there's frost on the pumpkin, ladies and gentlemen, and thank goodness for a warm house, you know. Anyway, lots have been happening here. Of course, I'm in the crosshairs of a rather large group of ne'er-the-wells, and just listened to a broadcast by a couple of them just a minute ago, and it was actually laughable. And, you know, they've taken it upon themselves to crush people without any proof, and that's an interesting thing to do. But there'll be a slight response to Gladys and Abner Kravitz at Wing TV very soon. So I'll let you all know that, because it's just a laughable thing that they've done over there. Anyway, lots of stuff has been happening. I'm just trying to put together as much information as I can to get this Myron Fagan download straightened out. I mean, there are some things in this Myron Fagan work that maybe don't make sense in looking at them in reverse history. And I'm wondering where he went wrong as far as his predictions, and maybe his information at the time wasn't as clear or complete as the stuff we have, or maybe we're wrong on what we've got. So we've decided to find a couple of experts that have actually got a lot of knowledge on this particular man's body of work. One of them is going to be on today. Another one will be on Friday. Today is Eustace Mullins, and Eustace actually worked with Myron, as well as Benjamin Friedman. And, you know, we've pushed real hard on Benjamin Friedman's work, because it seems Ben Friedman and Myron were both working together to try to expose what they called the Illuminati, what some of them called Zionism, what others have called Ted Pike's use of it as evil Jewish leadership. Again, we don't want to paint a broad brush here and include all Jews in this statement, because certainly not all Jews are involved in any of this, and to say that would be nonsensical. Also, I want to come out and say that I am a little bit skeptical about the veracity, or the total veracity, based upon some inside information that I just received, and we'll probably talk about this on Friday as well, that the Elders of Zion paper, I think, might be, not as powerful to prove this stuff as one thinks. It does have a remarkable parallel to the events of history, and I don't know whether that's, rational or valid or worth looking into, but there are enough converse events or tracked events that we know about that would verify many of the things that we claim about world Zionism and what the goals of these people's efforts are. And we're going to talk about that tonight and Friday and tomorrow. After his great appearance on the Alex Jones Show, Eric Hufschmidt did a heck of a job yesterday with Jack Blood, and we're going to have Eric on tomorrow to discuss several subjects. One of them is the one I started the show with here today. We'll discuss with Eric just how ne'er-the-wells get their kicks on Route 66, I guess. But you know, we just do our best these days, ladies and gentlemen. In spite of the attacks, in spite of you know, I got people from every side of this issue everywhere just attacking me left, right, and center, which comes with the territory, I guess. You know, if you're over the target and people want to make a name for themselves, they want to do that to you because it's just what they do, especially marginalized people that can't get any traction. You know, it's interesting. If you go to Alexis.com and take a look at these people that just did this hit piece on me, they don't even show up. They get one per million, which is just the most astonishingly bad numbers you could ever imagine, which means they probably have a few dozen people listening in, not the millions that they claim. Anyway, it's astonishing in that also, in the fact is that they were publishers of John Kaminsky's recent book, and you know the position I came out on John Kaminsky recently because of some of the things he said on my show. And they were statements that I thought, looking at them, were not accurate. They were dangerous. They were all inclusive of the Jewish community, and I found them to be dangerous and offensive. And because of that, I had to apologize to my listeners for their being said on the show without a sufficient amount of challenge from me, which was my error. And I had to do a mea culpa in not being as strenuous as I should have been in resisting that kind of stuff on my show. But there were actually four major quotes in his interview that were, I believe, racist and xenophobic. And as a result of it, I made a very strong stand against that. And come to find out, they are publishers of his book. Well, I guess they have taken to making things up because it's pretty clear that I don't own a shotgun. It's one of the things that they talk about. I don't own one, which is amazing. And the fact is that you can go to the area police logs from my area and find out that I've had the area gendarmes here in the middle of the night and during the day on three different occasions because of people milling around my remote home. So if that's living in the attic, then I don't know what is, ladies and gentlemen. So anyway, but tomorrow Eric and I are going to do some we're going to have some fun with these folks over there, and hopefully they won't get any press coverage as a result of doing such a sloppy job. But anyway, here's the thing. You know, we've made some headway. Of course, if I wasn't, people weren't so upset. This guy got a guy writing to me about saying that because Mike Piper said that the article was on the front page, I mean on page 23, not on the front page, that discredits the whole USS Liberty thing. And that he cites an author saying it's all a hoax. When I've spoken to the commander of the ship during the watch, in other words, he was a lieutenant at the time, or a lieutenant JG, I'm not sure. But he was on the bridge at the time of the attack. His name is Lieutenant Commander Innes, and this man was there. And so he's telling me that this man is a liar, and that's astonishing to me, including Mr. Kyle and many other sailors that were on that ship. So, this, you know, they're coming from everywhere, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm fending them off. Thank goodness. You'll be right back after this with more on The French Connection. And, ladies and gentlemen, we are back, we are back, we are back. Lots of news today that I think is worth mentioning. You know, we've got... of course, I go to What Really Happened a lot because of his take on a lot of things, kind of parallels what Eric and I write about a lot and what we research about. And he's been posting some pretty powerful things lately about a lot of things, you know. Here's the interesting thing. I'm wondering if we're going to get any traction on this impeachment thing on George Bush. And here's the real reason I don't think it's all that important. I think George Bush is there to fall now. I think he's there to take down. I think they've set him up now to be the fall guy for all of their criminal movement toward tyranny in the United States. And I think they're going to put somebody forward who kind of promises to fix the mistakes of Bush and his kleptocracy. But they're not going to reverse any of the slide we've had into tyranny and probably over the next months or years slip us further into it. And not to mention that the financial side of things and the ledger, the financial ledger, is getting much weaker as we speak. The dollar is just getting weaker against the euro. Terrible. It's at today is over 1.23 to the dollar, which it hasn't been at for quite some time, and falling. And I think it's been about 4% slide in about a week. Now, those of you out there who know about currency trading, 4% slide in an exchange rate between two reserve currencies like the euro and the dollar is a very fast slide. And gold is running very, very hot again. We're at 566, 565 is a high today. These are also 25, 26 year highs for that that base metal, and lots of things happening. I gotta tell you, there was an article that I read yesterday about banks being told not to give people access to their safety deposit boxes, and there's reasons to be suspicious of this whole thing. It might be a little overdone here. People that I know in banking, one of them is a general manager, and he's part of family that I know about and stuff. So I talked to the people there, and they said, well, that's not happened here. And it's possible that they haven't heard about it, and I don't want to discount the fear of that, because at some point that may well be what happens. But there is a lot of questions about the veracity of that particular thing happening. So I think it's important that we keep an open mind about some things not being as real as we seem to think they are. You know, it's easy to let your fears run away with you, of course, and I more than anybody know that we have to keep our feet on the ground when it comes to trying to assess all the stuff that's happening around us. I can't predict a date, however, you know, the coincidence of the March invasion of Iraq happening on the Purim holiday on the eve of, and then that same holiday existing in March again on the 14th and 15th, and then having the vitriol turned up, I made a rather non-specific prediction that should be a date we should all take a look at, because they chose it last time for the very reason that the holiday represents an invasion of that area in the ancient text. And what does that mean? Well, a lot of times these folks do things by design, and usually has some hidden meaning in it. As you've heard on many shows, you'll hear Alex and Jack Blood talk about that a lot. And I think that new book, Magic Codec Magica from Tex Mars, it also talks about the dates and how these things are significant to these people. I believe that they believe those things are important. For what reason, I'm not entirely convinced it's real or not real. It might just be the way they exert their power, and they want people to believe it's some kind of divine decision, when it really is human beings deciding on dates that would give people those kind of fears. So let's keep that in mind anyway. And taking a look here too, you know, the using a here's a question that I've had for a lot of my Jewish friends and people who are working with me in the Jewish community. Why is it that Judaism can be considered a race and also a religion? Because to give them preference based on their religion, tax breaks and all that, and then giving that same group tax breaks because of their race, is a benefit that only they would be receiving in the country. I mean, so one of the questions I've had is, are they a race or are they a religion, or could they be considered both? And if so, why are special, compensations being given out for that status when others don't receive it? And then the way that they've foisted this upon federal lands, if it is a religion, which some would argue, Why would they be putting up memorials to religions on private on public property when you cannot put up a Christmas tree on public property? There is a double standard here that is very disturbing, and I think it's something that we should be discussing as well as with all these other things, because it's just a flow of history here, ladies and gentlemen. It's a you can't talk about these subjects without being considered a racist or a xenophobe or whatever. But I think you have a responsibility, and I think I do, because I'm broadcasting to a lot of people, to be as honest and forthright about my positions as possible, not to include that the many, many, many millions of people in the Jewish community that have nothing to do with this, and the big fear that I have that somehow they would become victims in the event of blowback. And you all know that blowback does happen. Take a look at history. And can you imagine, you know, your heritage is Jewish, and that's something that you're not that very tied to, although you do loosely maybe celebrate some of the holidays, like many Christians do. And then all of a sudden, political upheaval starts in the world, and you're all of a sudden held responsible for the actions of some megalomaniacs in Europe who claim the right to do these things to humanity based upon their Zionist beliefs. It would be insane for you to blame that Jewish person or that the person of heritage when they had nothing to do with it. It would be outright criminal. And I want to make sure that we are very clear with the people we're talking about when we discuss these Zionist issues. It is imperative, ladies and gentlemen, that we don't sweep up the entire group into this, because that is racism. And I don't practice that on this program or in my own life. So I think it's a bad way to go forward. So anyway, what else do we have here? I talked about the impeachment of George Bush and how it's going to work into the hands of the opposite camp, the Democrats this time. And the fact is, America is not waking up to this false fight that goes on between Republicans and Democrats. So all of this vitriol, all this anger being expressed against this chucklehead George Bush is really just a smokescreen for the next administration that's going to get blown in and, behind him, you know? And I think it's also a smokescreen to cover some of the stuff they're doing. Anyway, when we come back, we have Eustace Mullins. He's going to talk about lots of stuff, ladies and gentlemen. You're going to enjoy this interview. When we come back. Hold on to your hats. We've got an interview coming up here that hopefully is going to shed a lot of light on some of the issues that I've been putting up on the website here. More specifically, we have a gentleman here who has several decades of research and efforts being placed by him to expose the criminality within this Zionist, Illuminati. We got a lot of names for this stuff, but World Zionism and Rothschild conspiracy is the one I'd like to call it. His name is Eustace Mullins. He's been attacked by everybody, front, right, and center. And, geez, you know something, Eustace? I can understand how that feels, boy, because they're attacking me right now like you have no idea.
Well, when they come after you, they give you everything they got.
Well, they have been. I get it from both sides. I get it from other websites and people. It's fine, because obviously I'm making a difference or they wouldn't be doing it.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, here's the interesting thing. I mean, I've been reading Benjamin Friedman's work, and you knew Ben Friedman, and he spent a great deal of his own money and a lot of time on trying to get people to pay attention to these issues, and he was not very successful because he couldn't get the airplay he wanted. And so his tape, or his record that he made kind of fell by the wayside over the years, the 1961 interview and that he did over in a Washington hotel. It's resurfaced, and it is powerful in what it talks about and how these people manipulated the last century to create war, famine, destruction, enmity, and criminality throughout our world. And I want to know what your personal relationship was with Mr. Friedman, and was he as credible as I think he was?
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely incredible. In fact, his work has lasted. That is the great test of all, the test of time. And I see more Friedman stuff around now than when he was alive.
Well, he deserves a lot. If you know, most of the things that I've been able to check on, and I can't check on everything, but everything that I have checked on seems to check out. And
boy, God, Ben was a real scholar.
Well, he did.
He was an intellectual.
Yeah, he did a good job. And here's what he said. He was there in the 1916 meeting with Untermeyer and I guess who else did he send? Baruch and Morgenthau and a whole group of very, very high placed Jews from New York City and across the country to come to Britain and convince them that if they fought for that for a homeland in Palestine after World War One, they would get America committed to the World War One fight. And that seems to make sense to me and anybody who looks at it. What's your take on all that?
Well, it was quite a movement to get America into the war. You say America was isolationist, had no interest in the European war. And it didn't look like they were going to get into World War One. And if World War One had been a total bust if they had gotten America into it, because it would have been a small local war in Europe, it wouldn't have done any good at all for the conspirators. So they had to get us in, and Woodrow Wilson is the man that they chose to do it.
Well, I hear that Justice Brandeis may well have had a hand in blackmailing him. There is some evidence of that. I haven't seen it personally. What do you know about that?
Oh, yes, the Peck letters. You see, they blackmailed Wilson into appointing Judge Brandeis on the Supreme Court. And Justice Brandeis was also the head of the World Zionist Organization. So you know where his real sympathies lay. So after Brandeis got in, he opened the door for Bernard Baruch to become Wilson's czar of the War Industries Board. Baruch had total control over every industrialist in the United States. He boasted in 1932, testifying before Congress, that he had more power than any person in the history of the United States.
Bernard Baruch, they named the City University of New York after him, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, the Bernard Baruch Business College.
That's right, they did. It was right up the street from my university, and I remember that. Anyway, here's the interesting thing. They didn't stop there. In the 30s, what they found out was that they hadn't sufficiently destroyed Germany, and the terms of surrender after World War One didn't seem to be painful enough because the Germans were on to their little scheme, according to Mr. Friedman. So what they decided to do was create an economic boycott against Germany that forced the nation almost into starvation in the early 30s. Am I correct?
Oh, that's correct. You see, World War One and World War Two were caused solely by the fact that Great Britain couldn't compete with German quality. And that was driving Great England off the world market. So England faced their economic collapse. They had to destroy Germany, and it took them two world wars to do it. And now Germany is under complete control. Germany, the nation of Germany today is ruled by the German Marshall Plan out of New York City. Germany has had no government since 1945.
And it's still this way, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Well, here's the interesting thing. What they said was the German people actually caught wind of this conspiracy and felt some personal enmity toward Jews, but they did not strike out against them, did they?
No, indeed. In fact, George Sylvester used to tell me a joke. He said it was during the 1920s, there was a long parade through Berlin, Nazis carrying the signs, down with the Jews, down with the Jews. And at the end of the program, at the end of the parade came two Jewish bankers who were paying for the whole thing, Max Warburg and Max Oppenheimer. And so they carried signs, down with us.
Down with us.
Oh, very kind of great sense of humor. Europeans do have a good sense of humor. They have much more humor about politics than we do.
Well, the bottom line was that the buildup after the 1932-33 battle for the chancellery, which, of course, Hitler was able to take from his, well, actually, he killed his way into it, from what I understand. But he was financed, his war machine, his buildup was financed by these bankers, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Max Warburg and Max Oppenheimer financed everything. And they put up a mythical story that German industrialists had financed Hitler, which wasn't true. The German industrialists didn't like him and had nothing to do with him. All of his money came from Jewish bankers, which created a paradoxical situation that you had an anti-Semitic government which was attacking the Jews, and it was all financed with Jewish money.
Well, now, at the time, was anybody aware over the, you know, was this above board, or was this kind of clandestine financing?
Oh, this was clandestine. In fact, Aldi came into it years later after World War II. George Sylvester Buick told me a lot of it. See, he was the illegitimate son of Kaiser Wilhelm I.
Who was?
George Sylvester Buick. He represented Germany during both world wars. I used to kid him that he cost Germany victory in both world wars, and he was quite flattered to what I told him that.
And was he from the same Zionist camp?
Oh, no, he was old European aristocracy.
Ah, okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, I got a few other questions about Mr. Friedman. Then I want to move over to Mr. Untermyer, as well as Mr. Fagan. Ladies and gentlemen, when we return, we have a great resource in Eustace Mullins. Stick with us. And ladies and gentlemen, we're back. Daryl Bradford Smith, your host today. Got a great interview going on, but give you my details here. IamTheWitness.com is the website. And these subjects we're talking about are all available on that site, including Benjamin Friedman, Samuel Untermyer's transcript, as well as Myron Fagan's work. We're going to go back to Ben Friedman's work here. He talks about World War II, the destruction and all of the things that happened in World War II, being designed in order to get an exodus of the Jewish community from Europe. In other words, there was no event that was going to get them to migrate to the Middle East, to Palestine, and that these people, these megalomaniacs in charge, came up with a scheme that by having this hatred generated against the Jewish community, somehow they would get an exodus of this community, and by and large, it worked, didn't it?
Oh, yes. In fact, Hitler was recruited by the World Zionist Organization in 1923. He had this whole movement in Germany wasn't going anywhere, and the World Zionist Organization cut a deal with him in 1923. They joined and worked together, and that's how the Nazi Party was created. So you see, the Holocaust itself was created entirely in the Jewish community. The rest of the world had no problem with Jewish people whatsoever.
Well, their goal, though, was to get a population of them to get back into Palestine and then to exercise that Balfour agreement they had made with the British so that a homeland could be established. To what end was this being done? Why were they trying to set up this homeland, Eustace, in your view?
Well, they figured this homeland was at the crossroads of the world and that it would control the entire world. That's what it was like. It was about world domination. They weren't just looking for a homeland for the Jewish people. They were looking to dominate the world. Do it from the crossroads of the world in Palestine.
Are there religious overtones to this?
I have never found any religious overtones in everything. Everything is practical politics. Everybody's after money and power. I haven't run into religious people at all.
You haven't, but they do use religion as a smokescreen, don't they?
Well, they always use religion. Religion is a perfect smokescreen because you can say whatever you're doing for God, and who could criticize you for that?
Well, that seems to be what's happened then.
Oh, yeah, and exactly what happened.
Well, and I also understand that there are nonsensical ideas that they want to reestablish the Temple Mount after they've consolidated their power in the Middle East.
They certainly do. All those plans are in formation right now.
They are.
Oh, yes.
And to reestablish that Temple Mount to who welcomed the Rothschilds to the leadership role in that area?
Well, the Rothschilds have had the leadership role in the areas in 1880, the whole idea of a Jewish homeland of Palestine was financed by the Rothschilds from Vienna in 1880. See, there was never a penny put up by the Jewish community itself for settling in Palestine, because the Jews were very happy in Europe. They had no reason to go to Palestine. If you're living in a beautiful modern city, why would you want to go live in the desert? I mean, they're not crazy.
Well, that makes sense. And a desert, in fact, that is being fought over.
Oh, yes. Still being fought over, because it's still the crucial area of the world. You control Europe and Asia from that area.
Yeah.
So geopolitically, it makes sense. It doesn't make sense from economic sense. It doesn't make sense even from geography. You have to know geopolitical goals in order to understand what's going on with that. And the American people have no concept of geopolitics whatsoever.
Yeah, that's pretty evident. Now let's go to Myron Fagan's work here. He actually does a chronology or a timeline, as it were, for what he describes, not Zionism. He describes it more as the Illuminati or these consul on foreign relations. But aren't these just creations of the same Zionist leadership?
Oh yes, the Illuminati and Freemasons all came out of the Rothschilds in Vienna, Austria. And, Myron was trying to focus on the conspiratorial angle of the thing. He was a very brilliant man and one of the finest people I ever met in my life. He was the only person for years who had promoted my Federal Reserve book, which appeared in 1953, and it was really immediately in the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith unleashed a national campaign against the book. They labeled it as virulently anti-Semitic and myself as the worst anti-Semite in history. So, and they've never quit. They're still saying what they said in 1953, that my book is anti-Semitic, and people read it, pick it up and read it, they can't find an anti-Semitic word in it. So it really puzzles them. But Byron went against the whole establishment because he was an honest man and he believed in what he was doing. And he did it all his life. I knew him in his last years. He had finally left California for New York, and he was living in a one-room place in New York in a poor section. And his home was broken into almost every day.
Well, here's the next question. I mean, we're looking at this, at his work, and at Mr. Friedman's work. Now, there are some inconsistencies, but they have more to do with maybe events that didn't happen as predicted, but not necessarily the veracity of it all. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about your relationship with Mr. McCarthy in the 50s. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, Eustace is going to talk about Joseph McCarthy, and was this man on the money or was he not? We're back. We've got a short segment here before our top of the hour break. There, Eustace, you'll have a couple of minutes to get a cup of tea or something at the top of the hour. But before we go to that break, I want to ask you a couple of questions here. About Ezra Pound, what happened to Ezra, and what did they try to do to this man? They really tried to crush him. And what's the significance of his work in this whole thing?
Well, you know, Ezra was a completely free agent. He was blocked to no political party. And never espoused any kind of political feeling in his life. He was loyal to the Constitution of the United States, and he maintained his American citizenship. And all the years he lived in Italy, he was a loyal American. And that's how they indicted him for treason, because he was a loyal American. If he'd given up his American citizenship, they could never have touched him.
Well, what were the reasons for indicting him?
He was indicted by Alger Hiss, who was a specialist in treason. See, he was a personal assistant to Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was a KGB agent. And Ezra was quite anti-communist in those days, which most everybody was. I was, too. And he was very critical of the communist slave system. So,
well, communism is a fabrication of this group in order to de-godify the population or de-religify the population, if there is such a word. and also to make people believe that there is no difference between the effort of one as opposed to another, thereby destroying anybody's personal drive in life. And it's a disastrous philosophy that they invented, isn't it?
It's totally invented. In fact, the Rothschilds invented Zionism, fascism, Nazism, and communism, all in 1830 in Germany. And it's not a dime's worth of difference between any of them.
Well, when we talk about this left-right difference in our political system and all the fighting that's going on, what Myron Fagan talks about is that these are fights that they propagate in order to keep people separated from each other so that no one ever fights the real fight, which is the haves against the have-nots and the powerful elite against the, well, the sheeple, the slaves down below. And that is still very much in force, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. In fact, this talk about left and right is total nonsense. It never has been anything but nonsense. I have never met an extreme right-wing person in the United States, unless he was a double agent posing as an extreme right-wing person, which is usually the case.
Well, but now what we've got here is they also do this with races. They do it between blacks and
religion,
Jews and blacks and whites.
Absolutely. These are created out of nothing. Why, here in the South, before 1940, blacks and whites got along very well together. But all of this was created after World War II, the so-called schism between blacks and white people in the South. It has, and the Ku Klux Klan, which is a Masonic organization, the Klan Kleagle and all that, these are Masonic terms. And that was created to drive a wedge between blacks and whites in this, all throughout this country, and it still exists.
Yes, it does. I'd like to talk a little bit when we come back after the break about Albert Pike as well.
Oh, yes.
And some of his, the letters from Albert Pike that are claimed to be a possible forgeries. When we return, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a six-minute break. We've got lots more from Eustace Mullins. Please, stick with the French Connection.
Chance of showers in the afternoon.
And, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. It is 11:06 here in central France. Great to have you with me here. Freezing cold outside, weather report, but clear, unbelievably clear. Beautiful sky tonight. Going to be very, very cold early in the morning, I'm sure. But that's just been happening all over here in Europe. I mean, we've had some temperatures that have just been frightening. I mean, really, really frightening. In fact, in Russia, they had 96 below zero Fahrenheit in Siberia. Can you imagine that? Anyway, we've been talking with Eustace Mullins here, and Eustace is everyone that's been studying the subjects that I've been talking about for some time on my site has to defer to much of the work that Eustace has put together over time and his relationship to the people who also fought the fight with him. What we're doing today is discussing some of those people from the past that are no longer with us and getting Eustace's take on their efforts and the things that they put together, as well as some of the bad guys that he faced at that time. One of the people that you worked with, Eustace, in your early years was Joseph McCarthy. And Joe McCarthy was a, he was onto the truth, wasn't he? And boy, did they lambaste him toward the middle part of his effort to expose these people.
Well, that's absolutely true. You see, Washington had become a place where everybody knew what was going on, but nobody talked about it. And everybody accepted that situation until Joe came along as a Wisconsin farm boy from upstate Wisconsin. And Joe was horrified by what was going on in Washington. He started talking about it.
Well, I mean, what led him to this nest? Where did he get his information from when Joe was doing his research?
Well, when Joe came to Washington, he was a farm boy, and so he was picked up by the insiders, and his three mentors became J. Edgar Hoover, Father Walsh of the Georgetown Foreign School of Service, and George Sikorsky, a Russian communist Bolshevik from Vladivostok.
Now, those were his mentors.
Those were his mentors. Joe didn't know a thing about anything, and they told him what they wanted to hear. and they created his anti-communist crusade out of nothing.
They did. They wanted the crusade to take place.
Absolutely.
Why?
Because it was focusing on little Jewish shoemakers and people like that, and it totally ignoring the world banking forces behind these dictatorships like Germany and Italy and so forth.
So they threw some low-level Jews to the dogs and to kind of dissipate the vitriol and the anger against what they were doing.
Oh, definitely. And so the first couple of years that Joe was in Washington, that's all he knew, was what Sikorsky and J. Groover told him.
Wow. And so, and then he was set up to be taken down.
Not quite that fast. See, a friend of mine was working for him, George Westinghouse Cowles, and we were good friends. We had lunch together on Capitol Hill every day. So Cowles told me that he said, "Would you do some work for Joe McCarthy?" And I said, "Well, what would he want me to do?" And he said, "He would just like for you to do a little research for him." So I went to the Library of Congress and prepared a 40-page report giving the entire financial background of world communism, which was anti-capitalist, by the way. I mean, their so-called philosophy is anti-capitalist. Well, it was all bankers' money. And so this 40-page report that I prepared for Joe told the entire background of world communism. As Wall Street bankers and Swiss bankers and London bankers, and that was it. There was never a working class person associated with the communist movement. So Kyle took that to Joe, and he was really excited about it. It opened the world up to him for the first time in his life. So he took that speech and flew to Chicago and gave a speech at the Union Club, the top people in Chicago, and they went wild. And so he came back. He was on top of the world. And he had a lot of support. He was getting 25,000 letters a day from the American people. They were so gratified that at last somebody had told them what communism was.
Mm-hmm.
So he was overnight the most popular politician in American history. And it looked like he was going to take over the whole town single-handed. And they were scared. I mean, they were terrified. So that's when they started working on him. And they got a counterpart composed of Richard Nixon and Senator Cabot from Washington, from Massachusetts.
Henry Cabot Lodge?
Henry Cabot Lodge. The Lodge family and Richard Nixon and a couple other insiders. And they plotted Joe's downfall. They created this fake reprimand, which destroyed Joe completely. And what they accused him of was criticizing Democrats. That was the offense for which Joe was driven out of Washington.
For criticizing Democrats. Not for criticizing communism like they say today.
No. He was not really criticizing communism that much, but because he knew the background of communism, as the first person in Washington who had ever heard the true background of communism. And it blew his mind. Well, when Ezra Pound told me about it in Insane Asylum in 1948, it blew my mind.
Ezra put who in the Insane Asylum? Ezra was in the Insane Asylum.
Yeah, you see, they accused him of treason, but they had no basis for that charge, so they couldn't try him. So they said he's incompetent to participate in his own defense, and they had three government psychiatrists commit him to St. Elizabeth's.
And see, how long did they keep him there?
They kept him about 13 and a half years, but he was supposed to spend the rest of his life there because people on Capitol Hill swore that Ezra Pound would die in St. Elizabeth. He'd never be freed during his lifetime. And when I met Pound, he told me, he said, "I want the government to drop the charges and I'll walk out a free man." And I really thought he was crazy then because there was no chance of that. But 10 years later, he walked out a free man.
Wow. So they're willing to do whatever it takes to protect themselves from being exposed.
Absolutely. When they go after an enemy, they'll destroy you by any means that they can. And if one thing doesn't work, they'll try something else. And money is no object. This
well, I'm beginning to experience this now. As
Yeah, I've been up against it for 60 years. I know what it's like, and they do. There's thousands of dollars for agents who infiltrate you and destroy your operation.
Well, my operation is me, so they what are they going to do to infiltrate me other than to try to destroy me from outside? And truth is they're spinning like lie after lie, and they're coming from all kinds of different places, including people that most people would never think would do that.
Oh, yeah.
That's the oddest thing, Eustace. They're coming from places you don't believe that they would ever come from.
Well, that shows that they're desperate, you see. They're going to keep on. When they're desperate, they try harder than ever. I'm not offering you a very good prospect there.
No, that doesn't sound like a solution there, Eustace. You know, here, I want to go on to another fellow here that's very instrumental in this because he never did turn sides. He was always on the bad guy side. His name is Untermyer.
Oh, Sammy Untermyer, yeah.
Yeah, and he was as tied into this as you can get. And he did a 1933 speech, boy, that I've got the transcript on my website here. It is very powerful in the way he uses the lie of the day to explain to his constituency within the Jewish Zionist community. When we come back, ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask Eustace about this gentleman, Untermyer, this guy, this crazy man here, and see what we can't put together about him when we return on The French Connection. Gentlemen, we are back with our special guest today, Eustace Mullins. Eustace is a real resource, and he's a first-person witness to much of what we're discussing today, and the names and times of early on in this fight against world Zionism. It's been around for hundreds of years in its present manifestations, but it has its roots over the millennia almost. I mean, these folks have been fermenting problems dating back to as far back as the Spanish Inquisition and before, haven't they?
Oh, yes, indeed. There's nothing new here because their plans have never changed over the centuries. They remained consistent and committed to their plans, that they're going to go ahead with them regardless of anything.
Boy, you know, now how does Mr. Untermyer figure into all these activities?
Well, he was a key financial and lawyer to the big bankers in New York City. He put together deals for Bernard Baruch and the Rothschilds. He merged some of the biggest companies in the United States. And he charged enormous fees, $2 or $3 billion a fee. And he became a multi-billionaire many times over. He lived like a king. He had 60 gardeners at his estate outside of New York City.
Jesus. Well, he comes back from his European visit in 1933, announcing to the Jewish group that was, the Zionist group that was meeting that day, that he was successful in beginning the destruction of the German people. And that he was working on that boycott of their products, and boy, he was venomous about what he wanted them to do.
Oh, he really was. He was a venomous person, and that was a declaration of war against Germany in 1933. So World War II was actually inaugurated by Sammy Untermyer in New York in 1933.
Yeah, that was the day that that the war was actually declared, wasn't it, against the German people?
That was war, and that was a declaration of war.
Now, the fact that Hitler was stupid enough, or did he know, that he was making a deal with Stalin not to have a non-aggression pact and then turned around and went against that, why? They were both being supported by the same group. Stalin had his Zionist money supporters, and so did Hitler.
Well, because anybody that these people support, they support you in a given territory, but you cannot encroach on somebody else's territory. You see, when Hitler invaded Russia in June 1941, it was to stop Stalin from invading Germany in 1941, because Stalin had already committed all of his troops to attack Germany in September of 1941.
So Barbarossa was a plan to beat Stalin to the attack.
That's right. It was a blitzkrieg which was intended to be launched before Stalin hit him. It was rival gangs fighting over the same territory.
And both of them being financed, again, two sides of a war being financed by the same megalomaniacs.
Oh, yes. Well, you cannot really have a war unless you finance those sides, because it's very hard to start wars. Most people don't want to go to war. And therefore, you have to finance two sides to get them to fight each other.
Is that happening in Iraq right now?
Oh, certainly. We were dealing with Iraq all along. You know, Saddam Hussein was on the CIA payroll for 40 years, and the Bushes supported him all the way.
Now, who's in charge of America right now? I know George Bush and family are just underlings of these people.
Oh, yeah, they're lackeys. I used to tell people that the Rothschilds financed the Harrimans and the Union Pacific Railroad, and they financed John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil. So they were just puppets of the Rothschilds.
And they're not even way up on the food chain, are they?
Oh, no. In fact, I don't think they participate in the important councils at all. They just do what they're told.
Uh-huh. And who are some of the others that are doing it today in our country?
Well, it's the old families. You know, there's five Italian families that have controlled the papacy since 1825. It was the Medici and three or four other families. They're well-known in Italy.
But who's in control of the United States right now, Eustace?
Well, when you look at it, it almost looks like nobody is in control. The American people certainly are in control. They're totally out of control.
Well, but I mean, what families right now are controlling the strings?
Well, it's right out of Europe and the Rothschilds. But the families they're using here are the Schiffs and the Warburgs and the Rockefellers and people like that.
And how about the Goldmans and the Lehmans and the Kahn and
well,
the Stern?
They're all Wall Street stooges, that's all they are. They're just brokers on worlds on Wall Street. They don't have any real power. They make a lot of money. They make $100 billion a year apiece, but they don't really have any power. No, the decisions are made from higher up.
And the higher up is between Warburg and Rothschild.
Oh, that's exactly right. You're talking business now.
And those families intermarry, don't they?
They do. They intermarry constantly. And, in fact, they are more conscious of marriages than the royal families of Europe. Any marriage between members of those families is a business merger. That's all it is.
Really? And who is the lead component of that family today?
The lead component?
Of the Rothschild fortune. Is it the British part of it?
The British who?
There are three parts of the family. Some of them live in Zurich, some live in London, and some live in France.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're pretty well evenly matched. For quite a few years, 1920 to 1940, the Rothschilds were financed by the British and were controlled by the French branch. But they're out of power now. They were controlled after that by the London branch. I think it's still being run out of London.
And is that the same guy that this Edward there that you see pictures of Governor Schwarzenegger there standing beside and Warren Buffett taking pictures with? Is that the guy that's in charge?
For a long time there was a guy named Goldsmith, Jimmy Goldsmith, but he died, and I don't know exactly who's running the show right now.
Well, it seems to me all the intermarriage would start affecting their intellect. Is that happening?
Well, it probably does, and it probably has. They don't particularly show any intellect. They're just doing the same thing over and over again. They're not coming out with anything new. And that's why they're so predictable.
But how the heck do they get away with it so cleverly? I mean, how do they do it?
Well, they get away with it.
How come the public can't get their brains around this problem?
Because they've got control of capital, and they've got control of the seats of power. And the public cannot get their foot in the door.
Have we ever had our foot in the door, ever?
Well, we've had our foot in the door a couple of times. We had it with Andrew Jackson, and we had it with people like Thomas Jefferson. There's been people who turned up sometime that did some good. Now, Ezra Pound used to tell me that the last decent American president was Calvin Coolidge. He was a New England boy, became president. He was a very good president. But since then, it's all been downhill.
Oh, boy. Well, when we come back, we're going to have one more segment with Eustace, and we're going to discuss a couple of extra things that we have on our minds here today on The French Connection. When we return, more from Eustace Mullen.
Baby, do I feel high? Oh, me, oh, my.
And ladies and gentlemen, we're going to smooth our way right into this next long segment and then let my good friend Eustace Mullins go for his rest of his day in peace. Eustace, I want to talk to you about where we are in this fight, and are we getting traction? I mean, I understand from my efforts that they are very worried about what I'm doing. There are many others waking up. I can tell you, before I started fighting this particular part of the battle with Eric Hufschmidt, very few people could get away with talking about this without being completely mobbed by the ADL and the JDO.
Oh, that's true.
Now, we're actually getting traction, and more people are springing up everywhere, speaking about it, almost unopposed. Is that bizarre?
That's not bizarre. It's inevitable. They've been getting away with murder for years. They've been covering up all this criminal activity and hoodwinking the American people who are portrayed absolutely been bamboozled into going like pack dogs after anybody that the Zionists want to sickle on. And I went through that over the last 60 years. You're going through it. But what happened was the Internet. And the stuff coming out every day on the Internet that's really turning the world around.
And you think this is going to be their undoing is the Internet.
Oh, it certainly is, because people are finding an outlet there, and they're deserting the media. They won't look at television. And I know people in Phoenix, Arizona, and Atlanta, Georgia, spend all day doing emails, corresponding with people. There's just a heck of a lot going on.
There is, isn't there?
Oh, there is.
Well, you know, they can shut the Internet down. What would that do to this movement? To communist Russia and make it live behind closed walls like they did for China as well.
Well, that is exactly what they're doing.
Are they going to get away with it?
No, they won't get away with it, because people still have some desire to live. They're not all afflicted with the death wish. And people have been asking me at my lectures for 40 years, they say, when is the crash coming? When is the crash coming? Because they've been mind conditioned to expect a crash.
Mm-hmm.
And so they prepare them for the crash. Whenever they ask me when the crash is coming, I'd say, as soon as the government stops printing counterfeit money. Because this government, this economy, functions entirely on counterfeit money, and that's all that keeps it going from day to day. And without the counterfeit money, it would all crash tomorrow.
Well, what happens if the trading partners, such as China, no longer buy the treasury bills that they're printing for $3 billion a day to finance their future debt? What happens if they say, no, we don't think that that's a very good purchase? What will happen?
Well, nobody is independent. These things are all controlled. China is just as controlled as the United States. So they'll keep on doing it as long as they're told to.
Do you think there is a goal that they will implode the place intentionally?
I don't know. If a racket is paying off, why would you close it down?
Hmm. So you're not predicting that they're going to try to implode the economy?
Not at all, because it's one thing to fix a horse race, but you don't go down and shoot all the horses. That doesn't solve anything.
Well, I see most of the businesses of any substance moving out of the country.
Oh, yeah.
I see most of the American public incapable today of holding any technical jobs because their education system has been so destroyed. And I don't see that the American economy is a place where anybody really feels comfortable making money anymore. It seems like they're gutting it, like they're destroying it from within.
Well, it's been gutted. It's been destroyed. I just came back from a month in Ohio, right in the heart the Rust Belt at Toledo and Detroit, and what's going on is horrible. It's like the Depression in 1932.
Well, then why would you say that this is not an implosion intentionally?
It's an intentional explosion But I think the American people will survive it. I think they have the will to survive. They don't know what's happening, but they're still not going to take it lying down.
Well, what would you suggest I do to get this message out farther afield, Eustace?
What you're doing is doing it. If you get the message out at all, you're winning. And if you're letting people know what's going on, I lectured for years to crowds, as little as 6 or 8 people. But I started a lot of fires that way, and those people today are still doing what they can to get this thing solved.
Well, I'm doing it because I woke up to the fact that I saw what our future was. And, well, worse than that, Eustace, I woke up finding out that everything I believed in was a lie.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a starting place for everybody. You realize it's all lies, and you got to start looking for the truth.
And, boy, it's been a long, hard journey.
Oh, it's tough. I've been to the roof. When you start looking for the truth, the roof falls on you and on you. But if you survive that, you can keep going.
Well, you know, you would hope so until all the dogs are called out on you, Eustace, and you start getting worried, and they pick through your rubbish can and stuff, you know?
Oh, yes. They know how to give you the full treatment.
Well, yeah, you know, I figured if they're looking through my rubbish, they're not ready to do me in. What they're willing to do is probably try to find ways to destroy me with what they find in my trash, I guess. I don't know.
Well, they use anything they can, and they don't quit either. That's the thing about it. They won't quit.
Well, I guess then I can't quit either.
You can't, because they force you to fight whether you want to fight or not.
Well, Eustace, do you have any suggestions for my listeners and what you would get them to get motivated to fight this further?
Well, you know, we're on the verge of a revolution right now. This country is about to have the biggest waking up since 1776. And it's going to come, whether you want it or try to stop it or anything else. And it's on its way. America has always been the greatest country in the world, and it's amazing that the American people have survived all of the misery and lies and everything that they've been inundated with since 1900. But they're still going. The American people are still sound. It's an amazing situation.
So you're very hopeful then.
I'm very optimistic.
Well, good.
And being up at the Rust Belt in Ohio and in Michigan, which is a very depressing thing, it looks like a crash of 29 all over again.
Well, that's not very different than some parts of Massachusetts. If you go to Leominster and Lowell.
Terrible, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is happening throughout the nation, and, you know. Well, Eustace, I'm so happy you came on today. I didn't get to everything I wanted to ask you, but, you know, this is just one visit.
Oh, it is, but, you know, you never can cover everything. After every program I do, I think the 50 things that I should have said.
Well, I'll have you back, sir, if you'll be willing to come.
Well, I'm right here.
Well, sir, I thank you again, and I will be in touch with you. We'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, after this break with some closing things. Gentlemen, we're back. Let's talk a little bit about what else Mr. Myron Fagan spoke about here. It says, World War III is to be fomented using the so-called controversies by the agents of the Illuminati operating under whatever name that they are now being stored up between the political Zionists and the leaders of the Muslim world. The war is to be directed in such a manner that all of Islam and political Zionism will destroy each other, while at the same time remaining nations, once more divided in this issue, will be forced to fight themselves to a state of complete exhaustion, physical, mental, and spiritual, and economically. Well, I'm wondering to myself if that statement is not perfectly accurate, and I'm wondering also why, because this was in the early 60s, and what I do know about these people is that political reality on the ground often shifts the way they do their battling. It looks like instead of between Zionism and Muslims, the war that they've been fermenting has been between Christians and Muslims. That seems to be more about what they're doing. Now, it seems like Israel's trying to stay out of it and the Jewish group that is involved. But as Eustace pointed out, these people are not terribly interested in his view of religion. They're more interested in power and control. And they want world domination. And that has been his experience for 60 years of doing this. Now, I kind of believe that that's probably true, although they do use this religious divide and these differences that people have in their faiths as ways of setting us up to be opponents to one another and working this double-sided paradigm continuously, as they did in Northern Ireland against Catholics and Protestants, as they're doing now between Shia and Sunni, between Democrat and Republican, between black and white, between every single kind of group that can be opposed to another. And you'll often find that these people are behind them in preparation for the next battle. For example, environmentalists against people who are capitalists. There's always a yin and yang battle being thrown at us so that we will never discuss the real power structure behind these groups. And it seems to me that we're starting to become sophisticated enough to see through this. At least many of the people who've been studying this see through it. How do we make political capital ourselves on the fact that we do understand these political fights are nothing more than fabrications, and they're there to separate us from one another in order that we won't fight the real villains in this battle? Of course, they have massive amounts of capital to employ against us. It's not too hard to find people willing to do things for money, sadly. Some people believe in do things to get a book published. And, you know, when you see these kinds of behaviors, it makes it very, very difficult to understand how we're going to be able to coalesce around a single body, a single truth of these bad guys doing this. And look, we've often talked about the New World Order, the globalists, but when you get to the top of the pyramid, this is what Eric and I have been trying to get people to focus on. At the top of all these disparate groups are these enormously, beyond anything you can wrap your brain around, rich bankers of Warburg, Rothschild, and several other families that I tried to get Eustace to be more specific about. But Friday's show will bring some specificity to some of these other claims, and it'll give us an opportunity, I think, to maybe codify further the people that we are discussing in this battle. Because look, this is a huge conspiracy, ladies and gentlemen. One of the reasons why it's so hard for people to even acquiesce to its existence and its truth is because it is so large and it has gone on so long. And so many people say, well, geez, I would have heard about this years ago if it were true. Well, no, usually the biggest lies are the ones that get passed on. Smaller ones get caught because people are out looking for them. But the ones that sit over us like a horizon are often so large that we don't even notice them. And this is the kind of thing this is. You know, whether I'm living in this country or in America or Germany or anywhere else on this globe, these folks are in charge. And whether I've got a socialist claimed leadership in this country, or I have Gaullist claimed leadership, or I have Republican or Democrat like in America, or Tory and Labor, the two sides of every one of these organizations is always controlled by the same group and at the top of the pyramid. And of course, it's interesting to note that they use Satanism as a rallying cry for some of this stuff. And as far as I've been able to glean, it's only the lower level people that display this in any large way. The people who are really controlling things don't seem to be displaying it quite as much. Now, whether that's just my take on it, maybe on Friday we can bring that up as well. Ladies and gentlemen, when we return, we're going to close out the show here today, The French Connection. I appreciate you all listening. Stick with me. We have one more segment to go and lots more to talk about. gentlemen. We're back. We're going to end up this show today with a couple of more things that I'm reading here about this Mr. Fagan's work here. It's extensive. It goes on for a long, long time. You can actually listen to it or you can read it yourself. I prefer to actually read some of these things because I can go over them a couple of times. But it talks about the Federal Reserve Act. It talks about how Kennedy actually tried in his first administration to actually undo some of his learning, because Joseph Kennedy, the father, was certainly involved in some of these machinations of this group. But John Kennedy actually filed for and got the government to start issuing federal notes, which was a direct threat to the Federal Reserve, which was how these bankers used to control the nation. And, of course, according to this man that we're reading about here, Mr. Myron Fagan, he was killed for it. And interestingly enough, the first act on the flight back to Washington that Johnson committed after becoming president was to reverse that federal note decision of John Kennedy. So apparently he was angered, the Zionists were angered by Mr. Kennedy's actions, and the result, of course, was his murder. And, you know, you might well make the connection that Mr. Herbert Walker Bush, having been part of a conspiracy from as early as the 1960s, probably took a great role in that activity in Dallas, and has ever since. There are pictures actually of him having been there that day, and there is a direct evidence he was involved. So maybe he proved himself to be very helpful early on, and his grandfather, having worked with Harriman, probably put him in a good position to be a favored person in these in the next machinations, which took place, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, under the nose of the American people. But we all know that Lee Harvey Oswald was not responsible for the murder of President Kennedy, and nor was Sirhan Sirhan the responsible party for Robert's death. And we go on and on. I mean, you know, these people are under drug-induced, hypnotic-induced mind control. They're Manchurian candidates, ladies and gentlemen, and they acted out of some kind of sick programming that had been thrown onto them, and they were victimized and took the blame for acts that were political and about world domination of this particular group. Now, I'm wondering what's going to happen when this full story begins to be embraced. We need more people to read these documents, to look at them and understand they are first-person accounts of people who were there. You just had someone on my program who knew these men, both men that we discussed today, and he knew the Untermeyer character and the way that this man's business practices were meted out. I wonder how we can get this further afield rather than, you know, we need people who are serious about this this scholarship to start passing this as far and as widely as they can, ladies and gentlemen. So please heed this one. I mean, we need to do this. It's desperate. Take it upon yourself to do it as you wish. This is Daryl Bradford Smith. Tomorrow we'll have another great guest, so stick with me. We'll be back with more French Connection tomorrow.